This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Spotlight, episode number 4, was recorded on July 3rd, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. Our topic for today's episode is farmland investing, and my special guest joining me now is Artem Milinchuk, founder and CEO of Farm Together. Artem, it's great to have you on the show. I'm really, really excited to cover this topic because, you know, for, I don't know, more than a decade now, Jim Rogers has been talking about farmland. And just in the last few years, investing in farmland has become a super popular trade with some big family offices and, you know, super wealthy families. So what's the backstory here from a macro perspective? Why farmland and why now for farmland?
Yeah, absolutely. So big question. I'll kind of unpack it into several sub questions. Let's start with, you know, the macro story. And the macro story really is that since 2008 and even before that, we've seen a very large amount of money printing, both in the 2008 financial crisis and now. And we have seen interest rates around the world, you know, from Japan to Europe to US, coming down and down to now, you know, 10-year treasuries, I think, yielding less than 1%. So what has happened is that for the large pools of capital, which is pension funds, endowments, foundations, kind of long-term investors that historically have needed that yield to meet the requirements and low risk, they had to move away from investing just in government bonds to investing into stocks, investing into, you know, riskier bonds, private equity, now everything. And so farmland is just following a much broader trend of alternative investments opening up. When we say alternatives, we mean infrastructure, we mean real estate, we mean maybe some more exotic types of products. And so in 2008, the alternative investment market was about $3 trillion. It's approaching $8-9 trillion now and projected to reach $13 trillion in 2024. So really, you know, the very big answer here is that it's just harder to make money. Capital has bid up all asset prices, and farmland is just falling in that trend of more asset classes opening up. But let me talk specifically as to kind of what's driving the interest for farmland. There's several reasons for that. One is that before, even if you wanted to invest in farmland, what has happened historically is that farmland would just get passed on from generation to generation. But now with the average age of farm approaching 60 and kids not wanting to farm, there's actually a tremendous amount of land that is becoming available to outside investors. So USDA expects about 70% of all farmland to change hands in the next 20 years. So just a lot of that land is becoming available to outsiders. The other reason for the interest in farmland has been actually quite attractive absolute return profile. Farmland has returned from 1970 to 2018. Actually about 12% annually, which, you know, will be surprising to many, but it outperformed equities, international equities, real asset infrastructure, a lot of major asset classes. And so people are paying attention to those returns and saying, look, I think if I want to build a diversified portfolio, I should have more farmland. And so lastly, speaking about diversification, what's really important to note is that farmland is virtually uncorrelated to most other asset classes. And because of that, any kind of professionally managed portfolio wants to have that in the basket.
Okay, Artem. So big picture, if we look at the major trends in macro, lower returns on bonds, how do I, you know, diversify my portfolio and have something that's actually going to produce a positive real return? We got farmland, which not only produces rents on that farmland, so you've got income, but it's something that literally the world is growing in population size. We've got explosive global population growth. People have to eat. So this is an absolute essential. It's not like it's going to go out of fashion to eat the food that is grown on farms. But I want to come back and drill down on what you said about the absolute returns. Let's talk about traditional investments, stocks and bonds, and the way people construct portfolios. You know, you kind of think of you're taking your risk in the stock side of the portfolio, hoping to see a bunch of upside price appreciation, and you're using bonds to provide some steady steady amount of income. Of course, these days, that steady amount of income, as you say, is less than 1%. So do I think about farmland as supplementing just, you know, a replacement for bonds that can still produce real income? Or is it something that I'm also thinking about as a value appreciation, a price appreciation asset class that would, you know, also compete with stocks? Where does it fit into that portfolio composition strategy?
Yeah, so great question, Eric. And you know, you hit the nail on the head. Kind of the old school traditional thinking is that everyone should have roughly 40% in bonds, 60% in stocks, and kind of rebalance that as you go through your life and your risk profile and liquidity needs change. But when we look at sort of adding farmland, you know, it sits kind of in between bonds and stocks. So from a current income perspective, farmland provides very attractive current returns. So for example, in the one segment of farmland, what's called row crop farmland, corn, soybeans, wheat, you had a current income, so the cash flowing income that has been very steady at about, you know, 3 to 5% a year, which is more attractive than, you know, your 10, 20, 30 year treasuries. And at the same time, that farmland has produced periods of price appreciation that sometimes was as high as, you know, 5-10%. So it's really what we have found with our investors on the platform is that they see this as a something that is a hybrid that can give them that current income that can match the expenses for many years, because farmland is a great passive investment. You know, farms can last generations, I mean, centuries, and you really don't need to do anything to change anything on the farm. But at the same time, due to the trends you described, growing population, improving diets, and another trend I want to talk about, decreasing supply of farmland. Farmland also historically has shown about, you know, 4-5% price appreciation. And so you're kind of getting a little bit of best of both worlds.
Okay, so it is not a replacement for one of the other, but kind of a supplement to both sides of that traditional portfolio. But I want to talk now about the alternate investment universe, because I think certainly Macro Voices listeners are very well acquainted with that theme that you started with, which is, look, given the central bank policies around the world, anybody who's got half a brain is looking at alternatives to stocks and bonds, and they're thinking mostly about real estate and things also like precious metals, which are, you know, inflation hedges and real assets as opposed to financial assets. If I'm thinking that real estate is a really smart way to diversify into hard assets, not just financial assets, most people would probably think of that in terms of rental properties, you know, housing. Why would I think farmland instead of traditional real estate? And then I guess the other side of that question is, what about precious metals, which clearly are an excellent hedge against central bank money printing and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the way we kind of think about farmland, that it shouldn't replace any of the asset classes you described, but should be in addition to that. So let me talk about real estate first. We actually feel that farmland should be, in a way, at least a subsegment of real estate, because it's the same rental model. So what a lot of people don't know, but even today, 40% of farmland is rented already. So farmers and landowners alike kind of prefer that arrangement. And for farmers, what it does is that they get to spread their fixed asset base over a much larger acre. So it's very common practice to rent farmland. So in that sense, it's like real estate. But, you know, talking about inflation, farmland actually is a very good inflation protected asset class. So there's a well-known body in the farmland investment space. They call the TIA Kreft Center for Farmland Research now, Nuveen, and University of Illinois. And so they've shown that farmland has a 70% correlation to the CPI, Consumer Price Index, and almost 80% correlation with Producer Price Index. And so not even gold is closer match to farmland than inflation. So gold is, you know, is a good hedge as well. But in terms of that core inflation protection, farmland has no substitute. And that is because the farmland products literally go into thousands of end products that make up the inflation basket. So it's almost kind of a mechanical relationship with inflation. Now, talking about precious metals broadly, again, we think, look, you should have a little bit of gold in your portfolio, some real estate, maybe a little bit of Bitcoin, and a little bit of farmland as well. You know, we're not saying that you should replace your core stocks and bonds portfolio with farmland, but adding a few percentage points, I think, will look quite well in your portfolio. So, you know, one last data point there, and we're very data-driven at Farm Together. So, again, our research has shown, together with the sources in the space, that when you add about 15% of farmland to your traditional bonds and stock portfolio, then you increase your Sharpe ratio, which is, you know, the quality of your portfolio returns over standard deviation for kind of those who don't know that metric, from 8.15% to 8.61%, and the Sharpe ratio from 0.76 to 0.95. So really, you know, quite an attractive addition to almost any portfolio.
Now, you mentioned Bitcoin a minute ago. I want to come back to that because there's almost a whole new generation of investors who are saying, look, you know, precious metals, real estate, that's all old school thinking about how to get away from central bank money printing. The way of the future is Bitcoin, baby. It's all about crypto. It doesn't happen to be my view, but that, you know, that's a significant part of the market who has that opinion. What would you say to them? I mean, how do you fit farmland into the equation for an investor who kind of thinks that digital currency is the future?
Yeah, so one part of our ethos at Farm Together is that we want to be a marketplace where our goal is to be really good at sourcing and underwriting farmland. And then we have different types of investors with different views, and they can express those views by investing into different deals, different asset classes as well. So we don't take, you know, a strong view on what the world looks like in the future. But there is, you're right, a meaningful portion of people that think, you know, Bitcoin will replace gold, will have kind of the new digital currency world. And in fact, some of those crypto people are clients and investors as well in Farm Together Inc., so our angel investors. So definitely overlap there. Overall, I would say that if Bitcoin is kind of your moonshot bet, right, if Bitcoin truly replaces gold, then we can see, you know, prices easily going to 10x what we have right now or more. And that's kind of your, you know, your almost kind of startup type investment, your 100x investment, 1000x investment, if you will. Whereas farmland is something that is almost a perfect balancer then to that risk, where because of the real asset nature of farmland, the inherent quality of the soil, especially in excellent areas of the United States, it's hard to lose money on farmland as an asset class. The inherent capital preservation is very attractive, and there's attractive growth as well. So our answer typically to people who ask us about, you know, Bitcoin and farmland or crypto and farmland is that we think it's actually a good balancer to have both in your portfolio.
Now, I want to come back to the subject of the returns for this asset class, because you said historically farmland has about a 12% return. I think for sophisticated investors who really understand portfolio construction, correlation is almost more important than returns. So in terms of correlations to other asset classes, how closely correlated are farmland returns to, let's say, both stock and bond returns, but also to other real estate?
Yeah, Eric. So looking at the period from 1992 to Q1 of 2020, farmland versus stocks, the correlation was 12%, so very low. Real estate, 20%. Bonds was actually minus 11%, so farmland is negatively correlated to bonds. And almost zero correlation to gold. And that is the same case in larger kind of time sets and with other asset classes as well. So really, you know, that's what we love about farm, is just so a part of everything else and has such a different driver dynamic that for diversification does wonders. One metric I like to quote is that in Q4, from Q4 2007 to Q4 2009, the farmland index, the NCREIF farmland index, was up almost 20%. Whereas, as you remember, stocks and everything else was down 30 to 50%.
Artem, I'm amazed that there's only a 20% correlation between farmland and other conventional real estate, because I would have guessed a much higher correlation. I want to return now to the subject of diversification. Obviously, if I'm going to have a stock portfolio, I'm not going to invest in just one stock. I want to be in several different sectors, different industries, and so forth. In farmland, if I've got a piece of a farm someplace, have I covered that base, or is farmland itself something that is diversified in the sense of, is, you know, the land for a fruit farm different than the land for a wheat farm, or and so forth?
Yeah, Eric, 100%. So thank you for kind of teeing that up for me. So let me talk about now the types of farmland in the United States. So first overarching comment is that when we say farmland, we really do mean land. That means that we're investing in the land, not in the operating business, not in a, you know, vineyard that is a tourist kind of destination, really in the value of the land that makes money from rent or crop revenue share. So within farmland broadly, we have three segments. we have pasture land, which is about $600-900 billion in United States. And then we have about 1.5 trillion or so. That would be your cropland. And I mentioned three segments. So within cropland, you have permanent crops and you have row crops. So when we say row crops, we're talking corn, soybean, wheat, so those kind of products. When we say permanent crops, we're talking your tree nuts, your hazelnuts, almonds, walnuts. We're talking your apples, your cherries. So kind of the permanent plantings. And indeed, they all have different drivers. And within those segments, there's different drivers as well. So, I mean, as you can imagine, for pasture land, the main drivers will be long-term prices on meat. So right now, we're actually not looking at pasture land at the moment. And that is because one, our expertise lies more in cropland, but B, we still need to get our head around the long-term trends in meat consumption due to diet changes as well as climate change. So what does it mean for farmland? So we're kind of not touching that at the moment. In the other crop types, so the row crops, I would almost compare it to high-grade bonds. It's very stable, very safe. As I mentioned, from 1990 to 2020, every year that land returned in cash income about 4 to 5%. There was not a single negative year of returns. And there were a few periods of price appreciation that was more than 10%. And the rest of the time, it was kind of inching up at, 2 to 4% increment. So that would be your safe, stable kind of total return target right now would be 7 to 9%. So it's also something that you can invest and forget. We have investors that invest in row crops cross-generationally. And they think about this as, I'm going to leave this to my kids, to my grandkids, or I'm going to, some of the more wealthier folks. This is how I'm going to back my endowment, my foundation, some sort of charity program I'm running. So really, that's kind of the row crops. And then lastly, and then I'll pause for questions. The permanent crops are kind of the most sexier, if you will, investments. They have returns that can be 10 to 15%, some of them even higher than that, 15 to 20 and more. And they are more volatile. So you definitely have periods of lower income, prices going negative as well. But overall, you can expect higher return, but higher volatility as well. We deal primarily right now in that permanent crop space because with our expertise in-house, we feel we can address most of the risks that cause that volatility. And then, coming back to your original question is that you do want to diversify within farmland as well. You want to build a portfolio of different crops, different geographies, different water districts as well that we can talk a bit about. So just like in every other asset class, diversification is important.
Now, when we talk about these concepts of diversification and resilience to shocks that could occur in a portfolio and so forth, usually that's a hypothetical conversation. We happen to be recording this in the summer of 2020 when we've got probably a generational shock to almost every portfolio. So I don't even know how to ask this question. I mean, COVID-19, holy cow. I guess on one hand, you could say that farmland is one thing that everybody still needs no matter what. Everybody's got to eat. But this has upset just about everything. And I would think at least some crops, if the consumer of the crop is in a place where it has to be transported, and that's not practical because of the shutdowns, you could probably see some big winners and some big losers. How does this all play out in this virus-infected world that we're living in as we're recording this interview?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me start kind of high level and then drill down a little bit because, the devil is always in the details. So high level, when in Q1 2020, when everything else was already, down 20 to 50%, depending what stock and what market you look at, farmland had its first negative quarter, I believe, where the total return was minus 0.5% or something like that. So very, very resilient, kind of barely moved. And I think that for the year, it still will be a positive year. Now, as we drill down to more individual subsegments, we have seen some markets be dislocated a little bit. It's been due to COVID, for example, transportation issues at the ports of San Francisco and LA caused challenges in getting the crops to the Asian markets, and that caused some price pressures. But overall, when we think about the farmland versus the particular return for farmer that year, it's very different. So as I mentioned, farmland makes its return from rent, and that rent is typically paid annually upfront. And for cropland is actually in March, And then for permanent crops, it's, you know, it's a bit more varied. But overall, you know, what you see is that it's more that will the farmer walk away from the lease? And in annual cropland, and that almost like when it happens, you just can easily find another farmer. So the impact on that to the farmland owners has been minimal. Now, you do have a portion of your returns that are crop revenue share, and those have suffered a little bit. But overall, you're not looking, you know, as we were in April, at a 50% drop to your portfolio, not even close. You know, you might see, instead of, you know, getting 4% cash yield you expect, you might have gotten 3.5%. So really not that much of a difference. We do see right now, it's actually more to farmland-specific trends that there is short-term price pressures. For example, in almonds right now, where we had an unexpected record crop that led to very low almond prices. And we'll see kind of how that situation plays out through the year. But, you know, the flip side of that is that the properties that we have in the almond space, they had much higher yield than we expected. So perhaps that will actually offset the price drop.
Artem, does the COVID-19 crisis create any particular opportunities? It sounds like from what you're saying, maybe, you know, this is a good time to buy an almond farm because those prices are depressed due to logistic issues, which are certain to go away after the crisis has gone away.
Yeah, it's logistic issues as well as a record harvest that no one expected. Yes, we think so, at the right price, of course. As with any real asset like real estate, the price you buy it is one of the most important factors to consider, and we try to underwrite conservatively. So we think that buying almond orchards, especially in areas with great water, will still be a good long-term investment. You know, we did a webinar on almonds, and almonds have been around for thousands of years. And in fact, sorry, Eric, quick side note, fun fact, always gives me a chuckle. Almond milk was actually introduced in the kind of late 10th century, 11th century by the Christian church as an alternative to animal-derived milk because of the fast of the different Lents. And so the first hipsters were actually the European Christians.
So this is not a new trend, almond milk. It's been around for a while.
No, it's been around, yeah.
Artem, I guess my next question would be, okay, a lot of people think that the world is going to change permanently, at least in some ways, as a result of this crisis. Travel habits will be different and so forth. What does this mean for farmland? Are there any long-term trends or particularly opportunities that you see in farmland as a result or trends that might emerge from the COVID-19 crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we're seeing is that people around the world are becoming much more conscientious around safety and health and sanitation around how they go about their day-to-day life. They're also becoming much more conscientious about their health. You know, this pandemic might last for a while. We also had, if you recall, SARS, we had Ebola, so we might get something else going on. So people are waking up to the fact that we live now in this, you know, very interconnected world where diseases fly around unimpeded, and you really need to take care of your health. And so the U.S. food, U.S. fruits and vegetables, U.S. produce has some of the highest quality in the world. We have very good safety standards, and people around the world trust that. That is why a lot of U.S. food trades at a premium overseas. And so we expect that demand to be a major tailwind for U.S. food products going forward. You know, another aspect around that is organic. What's surprising is that a lot of those international organic certificates are actually not as trustworthy as you'd like. And so the USDA organic standards are trusted around the world as well. And so we think, you know, the US food will really win in this kind of post-COVID world. And then, you know, another point to mention, regardless of COVID, we still have the major trend of climate change slowly rolling over us, creating more and more uncertainties. And governments, nonprofits, regular day-to-day people want to battle that. And one of the really powerful ways to battle and even reverse climate change is through what's called regenerative agriculture, which is an emerging trend in the United States. We're looking to become a signatory to one of the standards here that essentially captures carbon from the atmosphere and stores it in soil. And so we expect a standard similar to organic emerge in regenerative. So you as a consumer, or you as a store, as a country can say, okay, I would like to contribute to that. I can do it through what food I consume. So overall, you know, the population is going to keep growing. People will look to eat healthier. People will care more about where their food came from and the supply chain. And so I think their U.S. is a global ag powerhouse and has a lot going on for it.
I want to shift gears now, Artem, and talk about the marketplace for investments in farmland, because I see remarkable parallels here to a trend I've been starting to follow, which is, you know, another guy that I interviewed recently was looking at how some of the smartest investors in the world are really starting to diversify into fine art and these multi-million dollar paintings. You know, you got to be really pretty well-heeled to buy a few of those and have a diversified portfolio. So he's basically started a business to securitize investments and create essentially a fractional ownership plan for investments in fine art. And I know that what you're doing with Farm Together is very similar, because this whole farmland thing became a huge trend for billionaires, for the biggest family offices. And in some cases, they're actually hiring an agriculture guy to have on staff just to manage their farmland investments. There's a lot of accredited investors who can invest in the asset class, but don't have anything close to those resources. So it sounds like what you're doing with Farm Together is essentially making this asset class of billionaires approachable to any accredited investor. What brought you to this? Was it inspired by farmland and your knowledge of farmland, or was it inspired by thinking about making an asset class that was out of reach to smaller accredited investors in their reach? How did you get there, and what brought this about?
Yeah, Eric. So I spent 10 years investing in food, agriculture, and farmland on behalf of a large pension fund in Canada, as well as on behalf of a private equity fund in Canada as well. Canada is very, very knowledgeable in real assets and natural resources. And what blew me away is that when, you know, I and my friends wanted to personally invest in farmland, with just so very few options to do that. And it just seemed like such a shame, because as I mentioned, I just think farmland is a really good investment for everyone. And so, yeah, it was the desire to unlock this asset class to way more people. It was also, you know, I really like the people in the food and the farming space. I just think they're good people. So I wanted to bring more capital, more creative capital to these people. And at the same time, you know, I saw a real opportunity to contribute to tackling climate change. And as I mentioned, farmland is a fantastic instrument for that. So it kind of all came together and like, wow, there's this huge market that almost no one kind of profession is looking at right now. And that is absolutely going to change. We see it already. You know, I'd like to be a part of that change. And so that's what led me to start Farm Together in early 2018.
That's fascinating. So you were the hired gun, the guy who knows all about farmland and how to buy it smart. And you know enough about agriculture to make that investment intelligently. You're being paid by a big pension or PE firm to do that for them. And you want to invest, you know, basically eat your own cooking, the what they're paying you to invest in, you want to invest your own money in, and you're unable to do so despite being an expert because you don't have the asset size to buy several farms of your own. So tell us more about Farm Together. This is, I assume, something that's intended primarily for accredited investors, people who can get into private placements and so forth. How does it work? Are people buying into a fund which turns around and buys properties, or are people buying fractional ownership in the properties themselves? How does it work? What's the minimum investment size? Who does it typically appeal to? Give us the rundown on what Farm Together actually does.
Yeah, absolutely. So the website is farmtogether.com. And the way it works is that our team that comes from that institutional investment background with expertise in farmland, we actually go out and we source the best deals. There's a lot of technology that also goes into it, as farmland is a very fragmented market. We also build long-term relationships with great farmers and operators, because your land is worth nothing if there's no one to farm it. And so what we do is that we go and essentially enter into agreement to buy a farm with a seller. We then have enough time to put a package around it and describe it, kind of put a page up on our platform, farmtogether.com. On the platform, very easily, you can learn about that particular farm. You can learn about the trends driving the returns. You can see what we underwrite, what we forecast in terms of returns. And then you can invest in a matter of minutes. Everything is fully done online. And so that way you can start building your portfolio of farmland. So right now we only have at any one time a few deals on the platform, but that's because we're still fairly young. That is going to be changing in the next months and years. where you'll be able to invest not just in individual deal, but indeed in a portfolio, in a fund, if you want to call it that, so that you can immediately start building a diversified farmland portfolio. The minimum check size varies deal by deal, but typically it's in the $10,000 to $20,000 range. So if you have say, you know, $50,000, $100,000, you could easily build a portfolio of 5 to 10 properties. We take care of all the management as well. So by management, what I mean is that, as I mentioned, land is typically rented out or contracted to a farmer. So we take care of choosing the right farmers, the right, you know, really strong operators. We provide the oversight of their work, and we kind of collect the rent and pass it on to the investors. The type of investor, really, you know, now we have hundreds of investors and thousands of users, registered users on the platform. And, you know, I can't really say that there's a particular type. It's everyone. We have active and retired farmers. We have finance people. We have tech people. We have executives. We have retirees. We have some family offices. We have investment advisors. We have, you know, a lot of domestic investors, some international investors, let's say from Europe, where, you know, yields are even lower. So I think, you know, it's kind of been appealing to a lot of different people in a lot of different ways.
Artem, tell me a little more about how these deals are structured in terms of how granular the investment opportunity is. Is this something where, let's say, you found a farm and you're going to break it up into, you know, one-fifth shares, and the price of a one-fifth share is X dollars, and it's a take it or leave it? Or is this something where you've effectively securitized it to where the investor can say, I want to buy $17,000 worth, and they get whatever percentage, you know, relates to that equity investment? Is it scalable wherever they want, or is it fixed share sizes, or how does it work?
Yeah, it's the second. So typically there'll be a kind of an increment that is about, you know, 10 to 20,000. So you can invest, let's say, you know, 15,000, 30,000, 45,000, and it's fractional ownership in an individual farm. Now, each farm at scale, you know, what you alluded to is that you need to be really a wealthy person to invest into diversified portfolio farms. One farm of sufficient size and scale will start at $1 million or more. And really, you know, the sweet spot is $1 to $10 million. So we're talking about per deal, we might have 20, 30 investors.
And you're acting as the property manager as well as the broker to introduce the sale, because you're handling all of the leasing of the farm to the farmer and the collecting of the rent and passing it on. So what does the fee structure look like for investors? How does this compare to someone, say, buying their own farm if they had the assets to do that versus taking advantage of your expertise and having you manage the whole investment for them?
Yeah, Eric. So first, I just want to mention we're not a broker. We don't take any broker fees, not registered as a broker. I want to mention that for regulatory purposes. We are an exempt registered investment advisor, registered with SEC, and we make money by charging an annual management fee. So typically the hold period for the farms is 8 to 10 years. We are working on introducing a secondary liquidity market, so you could exit your units, your share, way before that. But overall, you know, we think farmland suits people well for long-term investments. And yeah, we mostly make money from a performance fee and an asset management fee.
Okay, so similar to a hedge fund, basically the deal is I'm investing in this asset class and you're going to make a percentage of my winnings. Now, are you the principals in the firm eating your own cooking in the parlance of the industry and invested yourself in these deals, or are the deals only owned by outside investors?
No, we invest in every deal ourselves. Now, you have to remember that as a kind of younger company, still out there to prove ourselves, we don't get paid a lot. So the absolute number isn't as high as we'd like. But as we grow, yes, absolutely. I mean, that's why we started this, because we wanted partially to invest in farmland. So not only will we be eating our own cooking, but we'll be, you know, eating and hopefully putting more and more of our own money into that. We also want to introduce a compensation plan for our all employees, that as part of the compensation, they receive some ownership in every farmland deal as well. So yes, absolutely, we'll be doing that.
Okay, Artem, so you've got skin in the game, which I know is something I look for as an investor, and I think most of our listeners do too. And you're getting paid essentially alongside the investors. When they make money, you make money, which is the right answer to that question. Tell us a little bit more before we close about how this works. Is it only for accredited investors? Do you have to be accredited in order to participate? Do you have to be in the U.S. specifically, or is this available to international investors? Because we do have a large international listener base. And give us also the particulars of the website and how people can contact you if they want to get more information.
Yeah, absolutely, Eric. So it's open to international investors and is open to U.S. accredited investors. And we have quite a few international investors from all around the globe. The only limitation there is that, well, there's, of course, the usual KYC AML checks. And you also have to be investing from a what's called a FATF country, basically countries that are signatories to the anti-terrorist financing global agreement. But you know, most countries fall under that. In terms of the website, it's farmtogether.com. It's really registration in a matter of minutes. You can quickly start learning about the deals. As mentioned, again, the minimum check size is $10,000 to $20,000. And the target returns net of all fees are typically in the 9 to 12% range. The cash yields that we look to offer are net around 4 to 6%. And the hold periods are kind of 8 to 10 years. Yeah, we really look forward to seeing your listeners on the website. And my personal email is artem@farmtogether.com. So I'll spell it. It's A as in Alpha, R as in Romeo, T as in Tango, E as in Echo, M as in Michael @farmtogether.com or just info@farmtogether.com.
Well, Artem, I really appreciate a terrific interview. I think you're onto something really exciting here. And I think this overall trend of securitizing investments that are popular with billionaires and making them available to all accredited investors, I think you're onto a really hot sector. And I think that a lot of other people, I'm very curious to see what the next guy is going to come up with in terms of what the next asset class it is that's going to be securitized by an entrepreneur like yourself. So thanks so much for joining us, and I really encourage our listeners to check out farmtogether.com.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.